come up here and see the snow again, how God provides moisture in different ways, and it's just a blessing. Tonight, I would invite you to 1 John chapter 4, and tonight I want to, and again, I want to read the whole chapter, but I want to tell you what we're going to preach about first, just so you know what to look for, you're not guessing or wondering, and I think that'll be a little bit of an advantage. You know, we've talked about different things, about the fear of God, the blessings of God. Tonight, what I'd like to talk about is an aspect of love, but the title of the message is called Loving an Invisible God. So you think about that, think about love, loving a God that you can't see, you've been told about all your life, but we love God. I think I hope we all do here. Sometimes that feels a little, you know, what does that actually mean after a while? You know, I know I love my wife. I know when I get along with people and when I don't, you know, it's very physical. It's very, you know, people are here, we can see them. But who is God and how do you love an invisible God? So that's kind of what I want to. And that comes from if you follow along while I read this, you'll see in verse 12 and then verse 20, kind of the central verses, I guess. But I'll read those now, then we'll read over them when we get to them. But verse 12 says, "No man hath seen God at any time. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us." And then, what did I say, verse 20. "If a man say, I love God, and hate his brother, he is a liar. For he that loveth not his brother whom he hath seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen?" It's a logical question. It's a question of logic. And so, let's think about that. And anywhere else you see the word love in here, be thinking about that as we read this. Okay, 1 John 4. "Beloved, believe not every spirit, but try the spirits, whether they are of God, because many false prophets are gone out into the world. Hereby know ye the Spirit of God. Every spirit that confesseth that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is of God. And every spirit that confesseth not that Jesus Christ is come in the flesh is not of God. And this is that spirit of Antichrist, whereof ye have heard that it should come, and even now already it is in the world. Ye are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world. They are of the world, therefore speak they of the world, and the world heareth them. We are of God. He that knoweth God heareth us. He that is not of God heareth us not. Hereby know we the spirit of truth and the spirit of error." We talked about that just a little bit last night, didn't we? About, the night before, about truth. And so that's in here as well. But thinking about love, verse 7, "Beloved, let us love one another, for love is of God. And everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. In this was manifested the love of God toward us, because that God sent his only begotten Son into the world, that we might live through him. Herein is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his Son to be the propitiation for our sins. Beloved, if God so loved us, we ought also to love one another. No man hath seen God at any time. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us. Hereby know we that we dwell in him, and he in us, because he hath given us of his Spirit. And we have seen and do testify that the Father sent the Son to be the Savior of the world. Whosoever shall confess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, God dwelleth in him, and he in God. And we have known and believed the love that God hath to us. God is love, and he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in God, and God in him. Herein is our love made perfect, that we may have boldness in the day of judgment, because as he is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casteth out fear, because fear hath torment. He that feareth is not made perfect in love. We love him, because he first loved us. If a man say, I love God, and hate his brother, He is a liar, for he that loveth not his brother whom he hath seen, how can he love God whom he hath not seen? Now, I'm not going to do an exegesis on this whole chapter, all the verses, and go down through it. There's so much there that, I don't even know if I understand it all. You know, when we talk about trying the Spirit and seeking truth, love, it's a huge topic. And you know, there's many, many parts about love. Let's go here with our minds a little bit. Have you ever tried to prove the existence of God to someone? I'm sure a lot of you have. Maybe you've been a witness to your neighbors. You've kind of, you know, told them about church, invited them to church. Maybe you run into an atheist. You know somebody that doesn't believe in God. They've had some experience. They claim that they don't believe in a God. If you've ever done that, you understand how hard it is to prove God's existence with just pure dogma and doctrine. You know, you can go to a person and say, you know, our church really believes that you should do this, this, and that, and here's the reasons why. They're like, well, I mean, good for you guys. That's nice. Our church does it this way. Or I think this, you know. Although, you know, we don't underestimate the power of the Bible. We don't do that. You know, somebody can pick up the Bible and read it and find God without, you know, and that's all. The written word can and does convict people at times. But, you know, by and large, you can't prove God by showing an atheist that the Bible tells us about creation. They already know what you think about God and creation. You can't just tell somebody, or you're a man that is you've always been hard to get along with. You know, your proverbial neighbor that you're having a dispute with over the border fence, and tell him, look, Jesus said we should turn the other cheek. I'd really like it if you did that. And by the way, you should believe God. You just can't get anywhere with that kind of dogma and doctrine. In fact, often the opposite is true. It seems like people who are atheists, they're atheists because of what the church believes, because of what they've seen in the church, and what they've seen the church do because of dogma. And I'm just going to go through a few things in history that have, you know, whether you know your history or not, these things have made dramatic impacts on the testimony of Christians. They are, in my experience, one of the main drivers of atheism and skeptics and cynics in the world. You take things like the Crusades back the year 1000, 200 years of what they called holy war. Imagine such a thing, a war that's holy. It was popes and Christians, those elite, powerful back then, organized to try to take over Jerusalem from the Muslims. And it's really hard to say. History back then, you know, it's the Dark Ages. They didn't keep track of things like they do now. But they think somewhere between 1.5 and clear up to 6 to 9 million people were killed by the Christians through those Crusades. Now, think about this. Who else do you know? There's a rather famous guy that killed something like 6 million people in recent history. Starts with a H. Hitler. Do you know anybody that has named their child Hitler? Have you ever kind of debated that back and forth with your husband? I want to name my son Hitler, and you're like, it's out of hand. I don't know of anybody that even considers the name Hitler, because he's killed six million people. He's a horrible person. Why would people want to be Christians and name themselves a Christ follower after the Crusaders, who in the name of Christ killed 6 to 9 million people? You see where I'm going? I mean, you see where that ends? You know, I think you're following the logic there. What about the slave trade? Now, I don't know a lot of you know about the slaves. I didn't really know about this till kind of recently. Have you ever heard of the slave dungeons of Ghana? So over in Africa, on the west coast there, I guess it was, in Ghana, the town, it was happen different places, but I would love to go there sometime. I mean, I'd trade in that for a Caribbean cruise any day. I'd love to go to some of these places. One of them is the Dungeons of Ghana, and it's where they'd capture their slaves. It's kind of like the stockyards, you know, like for cattle. They'd bring in all the slaves, and they'd put them in these big dungeon holding pens. Just imagine this church, but they just pack them in there. In fact, it was so inhumane and hot, and a lot of them would just die in there until they got them shipped. They're waiting on a ship to come to port. But evidently above that, there's a big stone or whatever dungeons. Above that was where they had a chapel. And so Sunday morning, the Christians would meet, you know, the slave catchers or whatever, and they'd have church up there. And, you know, often they could actually, the slaves could hear the church and the singing going on. And in church, if there was a kind of a lull in the preaching and the singing, you could actually hear the groans of the slaves and the suffering that was happening below the chapel. You want to be a Christian? If you were down there in that dungeon, would you say, "Well, I think those Christians are pretty neat people. I'd like to be one of them." You could explain to them how right you were, how you were the right church. You think they'd want to join you? What about the Rwanda genocide, where at the time that Rwanda over in East Africa there was, and maybe still is, the most Christian nation in all of Africa, okay? So over 90% of them were Christians. But in their ethnic, about the time we got married, and I was paying attention to it, it was fascinating to me, and I was keeping track of, I think it was 94, we were married in 95. Listen to this. 1 million people killed in the span of 100 days. Okay? And most of them with machetes and barbaric tools like that. It was Christians, ethnic groups, but Christians killing Christians. And here's another place I'd love to go. Call me crazy, but again, I'd trade in any Caribbean cruise for a chance to go there. But they would be pursuing their ethnic enemies. They'd, in panic, run into the churches. Just imagine filling. I've seen pictures. You can go on YouTube or Google and look it up. They'd pack the churches. They'd come in, and they'd just start hacking people to death. There's quite a few of those churches that they left as is. Okay, so you can go into these churches as museums. I don't know if our Western sensibilities would be up to it, but the bones are still there. You want to be a Christian? Follow the God of the people that did that? How do you and I convince people of a God who's invisible? You know, these are just a few of the atrocities committed by Christians that have turned people away from God, and it's certainly not Christianity. It's not all Christianity. Religion in general has been a very violent, bloody business. It was religious people that killed Christ. You know, the Muslims, they're notorious. They are a very bloody religion. In fact, their Bible, their Quran teaches it very plainly. And so religion is, in general, a very bad name for violence. You can go to the Reformation days. You know, we consider ourselves Anabaptists, but you know, there was a time when the Catholics and the Protestants were killing Anabaptists. And then you get to North Ireland, and the Protestants and the Catholics are killing each other. In the name of God, you know, they claim to love, they claim to serve God, and in the name of Jesus, go kill people in the name of a man who would not even pick up a sword. So how does this all work? There are two verses in the New Testament that tell us very plainly that God is not seen by man, and that God's plan for this problem, what God's plan is for this problem of his invisibility. Okay, John chapter 1, verse 18, we read that last night. No man hath seen God at any time. The Bible tells us that. The only begotten Son, which is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him. And then if you go to that verse is telling us that God chose his Son, Jesus Christ, to put on flesh, to be the skin of God, to come here and be the divine expression of an invisible God. And as he went about doing good and performing miracles, Jesus said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. I will show you what I have done. I will show you what the Father is. God did not choose to just write a book and tell us about who he was or to put a projector up and show us who he was, but he sent his Son out of love to teach us what he was like. That was our vision of God. He became the skin of God. And there's a lot that could be said about that. He became flesh and dwelt among us. And it says we beheld his glory and his majesty. That John says we were eyewitnesses of his glory, John and Peter. We felt him with our hands. We've seen him with our eyes. Jesus said, if you have seen me, you have seen the Father. If you've seen me, then you've seen the invisible God. And he didn't do that by cutting a swath through the Roman Empire and just killing hundreds of thousands of Romans to set them free. No, he didn't do it that way. He did it through his love. He did it through his sacrifice. And he said, if you have seen me, you have seen the invisible God. But here's a more interesting verse almost. In 1 John 4, verse 12, that we just read, it says, no man hath seen God at any time. Now, this is the second time the Bible tells us that no man has seen God at any time, that God is invisible. But it says this time, rather than just Jesus came to earth to show us God, it says, if you want people to see the invisible God, if we love one another, well, then God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us. And so what you see in that little series of thoughts there is that first Christ came to show us the Father. And as we have accepted and given our allegiance to Christ, we in turn, by mirroring the way Jesus showed the Father to the people around him, we are able to point people to Jesus and the Spirit that lives in us, who in turn points them to the Father. That's how you see the invisible God. And of course, Jesus prayed in the high priestly prayer, I in you, Jesus saying, I in you, and they in us, speaking about God and his Father, that they may be one. And in that oneness, God and the Father and the Son are a part and become visible. The bride becomes visible. Now, if these verses are true that we just read, and we believe they are, how do you worship a God that you can't see? What is the best way for you as Christians? And I know I'm talking to believers here that have not committed a lot of atrocities, as far as I know. I know you're probably imperfect human beings. You've probably done some things, but by and large, you're wanting to serve God. What is the best way? How do you and I serve a God that you can't see? And how would you go about proving the existence of a God that literally nobody sees? At best, you know, and I love to argue. If you get me into a good argument, I think it's kind of fun. I like to compete ideas and throw things around. But, you know, if you're able to argue science, you know, based on human common sense and reasoning, that nothing cannot produce something, you know, there are some very, very, very intelligent people that have laid out a case for Jesus' existence and his resurrection and all this. And there's also people, very, very, very brilliant people, that have laid out a case for why creation is not right and why evolution is correct. And so you have both sides of it. I've enjoyed listening to what they call apologists. And I've listened, I'm sure some of you have done the same. You know, you can listen to some of those debates and maybe some of the ones I get into, and they start to get heated. You know, you get kind of animated and you're like, this idiot's just not paying attention to the real true argument. And you can get kind of heated. And I've watched some that were very, very, it almost makes you cringe, because it feels like the Christian's gone on a bit of a crusade. Okay. One of them, though, there's a man by the name of John Lennox. I don't know how many of you have heard or listened to him, read his books. I simply love that man's approach. If I knew him any better, I think I could say I love him, but I think I do. He is such a kind, gentle spirit. He's known for it. And he gets into some very hostile crowds. He's debated some of the most dynamic, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins. He's debated all of them. Mathematicians at Oxford University. Brilliant man. Very, very kindly person. And he has, by his own testimony, by the testimony of people, he'll fill up stadiums or classrooms with people that will listen to them. And I've heard him say, and I've heard other people say, that more people have been converted to Christ because of the kindness and the love, the gentleness, and the sheer respect he showed his opponent over what he actually said in his arguments. In fact, I remember watching a debate where at the end, how do you win a debate? How do you know who won? Everybody thinks, you always think you won the argument, right? But they kind of do a poll in the audience. They vote, and they have different ways of kind of deciding who won this debate. And John Lennox and Christopher Hitchens, which Christopher Hitchens was really, really good at what he did. And he was an atheist, a very strident atheist. And he would tear people apart. He was merciless. He was mocking. I mean, he went down the list, Mother Teresa, anybody, any religion. Nothing was sacred to him. But I watched him stand beside John Lennox after the debate and with a very pleasant look admit that he had lost the debate to John Lennox as friends because John Lennox had been so kind. And here's the thing, love almost always wins. Like, you, what are you going to do against someone that genuinely loves you and cares about you? Love is always the strongest argument. People respond way more to what they sense in you and feel in you and way more than what you tell them. How they go away, and I've just cringed at myself. I have the opportunity to stand before people and throw out a bunch of words. I regret sometimes, and I've tried to get better at it, more sensitive, not just in preaching, but just conversation. It is so easy to say something that just later I'm like, I've just sounded so offensive, and I picked the wrong words. And some of the time, you probably know what it's like to be on the receiving end of some of that, but the problem with that is you can be so fluent and say so many things, but when people walk away, it's what they feel rather than what they heard. That's why false doctrine can be so dangerous. You get somebody flashy and they can see a lot of things wrong and even against Scripture, but boy, if they're charismatic and they pat you on the back and they love you, that's a powerful argument. So we have to be careful on that side, but if you have truth, if you're sincere, love is the best argument. If you think about it, all the ways God could have revealed himself. Remember, God is invisible. No man has seen God at any time. So God's thinking in heaven, I'm going to prove to the world that I exist. And somehow he decides he's going to do it without love. He's just going to, he's going to find some other primary method. Because it was love, John 3:16 says, that God sent his son into the world to be that divine expression, to convince us about an invisible God. It was, for God so loved the world that he sent his son. And, what other options, have you ever done a little mind experiment and thought, what other options could have God come up with besides that one, okay? And I don't know what it would have been. God could have, he could have used fear and threatening, just filled the sky with thunder and lightning and said, okay, I'm not going to let up until you guys all believe there's a God, or I'm going to send hail till you guys finally fall on your knees and worship me. We see what happened to Pharaoh. He just hardened his heart. He could have written the Sermon on the Mount up in the heavens. Matthew 5 through 7, just on a rolling, scrolling. So every time you went outside, a romantic couple, whatever, looking at the moon or the star, it was just always there. You couldn't help but see it. He could have forced everybody to read the Scriptures. He could have proved that creation was. You ever think about it? God is a creator, and how magnificent creation is. We talk about nature and how that draws us, and there's so much inspiration when you go, to Waterton or the Big Sur, see the, Pfeiffer Beach with I still can't get over that, violet sand. Have you ever heard of such a thing? It's just so, it's so amazing how God works. But imagine if God said, I'm going to prove to these people that I'm the creator by, you know, I'm going to start moving mountains around until somebody, so I get somebody's attention, you know, like the Rocky Mountain range would shift and pretty quick it'd be east of you and God would really impress you. He'd just put on a big demonstration. He'd move the stars around. He'd make the North Star point south and they'd be moving around. And until people started believing in me, you just never knew which way north is. You know, he could have done that. He could have done all of that. He could make the sun stop and go backwards. Imagine you get up in the morning, and all of a sudden you're just headed towards midnight and breakfast the day before, like he did in Hezekiah's time when he turned the sundial back. God could do all of that to us. He could force us to recognize that, boy, something's going on around here. But he chose love. You ever think about that? Again, it's one of those concepts we just take for granted, especially if you have a good marriage and you're getting along with your family and you know what love is. It's so easy to take that for granted. But God chose love to reveal himself to mankind. He sent his begotten son. And today, for us as church people, God still chooses love. And he chooses the love you and I have towards each other, the love I have towards Joel, the love Joel has towards Richard, the love Richard has towards Ray. God uses that to show the world an invisible God. And without that demonstration of love, God sending Jesus and the Holy Spirit into us, it profiteth nothing. And I think the same is true about all our dogma, you know, and our religious beliefs. You know, we can become so interested in God, in proving the existence of God, that we lose all interest in the things of God. C.S. Lewis, I'll say it again. We can become so interested in proving the existence of God and lose all interest in the things of God. So I have a few points here I want to go through. Okay, so point number one is burden bearing. These are some of the ways you as a congregation, and you know, I'm not talking about the world outside there right now. I think we all have time. You know, we're going to dismiss in a bit, and you know, we'll soon be out there. But as a congregation, it starts here with this basis, right? So burden bearing. This is one way we can serve and love an invisible God. Point number one, Galatians 6, verse 2 says, bear ye one another's burdens, and so fulfill the law of Christ. And the law of Christ is love, okay? It's love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, soul, and strength, and might, and thy father's self. Now, I have had two nephews, and one of them has spina bifida. And I just think of this. This just comes to my mind. To me, it's such a beautiful example of bearing one another's burden. It was a huge burden. My sister-in-law, she works so hard. I can still see her picking up that child as he grew. He's almost 20 now. And she'd pick him up, put him in the van. My brother-in-law, wheelchair, slowed their life way down. Many emergency rooms. But they love their child, and one of the things they did is my brother-in-law, he bought this, he likes to climb mountains, he's just systematically climbing all the highest peaks in Oregon, and so he bought this really specialized wheelchair type thing, made for it, and one day he got, well, it wasn't one day, it was quite a bit of planning and so on, but he got a bunch of cousins and uncles and just, you know, how it would be. Summer help, and late one fall, a whole bunch of, my wife and I were invited along, but we couldn't hardly keep up, but they went to the top of the South Sister. Now, the South Sister is a little over 10,000 feet. It's a 13-mile round trip. It's 5,000 feet of gain, and some of that is they've got the red mile, which is just sheer up. It's loose volcanic, porous gravel. It was just amazing. It was just an inspirational moment. And his father stood there on the peak of the South Sister with his son, spina bifida. It was very moving to just people that were up there and watching that. I have videos of that whole train. I mean, they were just leaning into that. They had harnesses on it and so on. I get that picture, you know, bearing one another's burdens. And then last September, my other little nephew of mine was also carried by his cousins, his nephews, his uncles, to our little church cemetery. This little 8-year-old boy in a tragic accident in the hayfield. And that was one of the saddest days of, in our church. It was just a terrible thing that happened, but it was also extremely inspirational. The way people stepped up, figured things out, you know, you can imagine, you do it too. I know you probably have done it. And it was just, that dear, my brother-in-law and sister-in-law, you know, to this day, you know, it's been about 6 months. And to bear one another's burdens. And so that takes me to these thoughts of Jesus and when he was here on earth. And John chapter 5 says, there was a man that for a long time he was sick. He was just laid on a bed. And this was the man at the pool of Bethsaida, I think. Or Siloam, maybe. I should have put that down. But probably one of the most sad, tragic phrases in the Bible is when Jesus comes up to him. And you know the pool there where when it was troubled, if you stepped into it first, which was really a choice, you know, if you were lame, if you actually needed help that bad, it was hard to be the first one in there. So he sat there for years. And as soon as the water was troubled by the angel, however that happened, you know, he just could never quite get there before someone else. And Jesus walked up to him and said, you know, what's going on? You know, you want to be healed? And he goes, I would love to be healed, but one of my disadvantages here among all the ones I obvious is I have no man when the water's troubled. This is a tragic place to be, especially if you're in a church. And so, you know, those that are spiritual, you know, to put me in the pool. And by contrast, you know, this whole idea of this man that was also sick and in a bed. And to me, it's such a beautiful story, partly because my nephew going to South Sister, but I'll just read it. He said, and behold, a man brought in a bed, a man which was taken with a palsy. And then they sought means to bring him in and to lay before Jesus, and they couldn't. So, you know, they went up on the roof. You may have been in the Middle East, some of you. I don't just imagine a hot day, and they're up there. These are men that probably have things to do, things going on, and he's like, hey, calling up all his friends. Of course, they didn't have cell phones, but somehow getting old. Guys, you know, Jesus is in town. I don't know much about the guy. I hear he heals people. I would love a chance to meet him. And they're like, all right, we'll take the day off and see what we can do. You know, and they pick him up, haul him in there, and they're just, the streets are plugged. I mean, can't even find a parking spot. Like, how do we even get in there? Well, he's in that building. And those guys, you know, they're good Alberta, ingenuity, you know, they're thinkers, they're processing. They're like, we don't got all day to be here. Sun's going to go down. Let's get up on that roof and just tear it off. I know you guys would have thought about that. You're that type of guys, right? And they get up there and pull that thing apart, and they're just like, you know, just letting him down. And boy, we picked the perfect spot in the roof. There he is, just right there in front of him. Just imagine Jesus being a bit amused, and well, that's pretty neat. Those guys. Good for you guys. says when he saw their faith. Who'd have thought? He said, your sins are forgiven you, and he healed him. The poem I love by Heaney, it says, it's called A Miracle. Just listen to this. Not the one who takes up his bed and walks, but the ones who have known him all along and carry him in, their shoulders numb, the ache, the stoop, deep locked in their backs, the stretcher handles, slippery with sweat, and no let up until he's strapped on tight, made tiltable, and raised to the tile roof, then lowered for healing. Be mindful of them as they stand and wait for the burn of the paid-out ropes to cool, their slight lightheadedness and incredulity to pass, those who had known him all along. You know, those guys had a roof to patch, but they didn't have to pull him back up through the hole. I'll bet he ran around the outside and climbed up there and helped him patch the roof up. They were a team. You couldn't separate those guys. They were in it for the long haul. And to me, that is just such a, you know, those people that knew him all along, they knew him, they loved him. You know, they knew his weaknesses. They knew where he messed up. They knew, you know, and you know what it's like. You know the struggles. You know, your wife knows your struggles, but you'd be amazed how many other people know your struggles. They know your temperament. They know how you fly off the handle. They know you're short-tempered or you're toothpick. They know everything about you. But that's where we come together and we support each other. We're not gunning for each other. We're trying to give each other the benefit of the doubt. You don't let it divide you. You're there for him. You know, the cultural slang, I'm not, you know, I'm getting a little older, so I'm not up on all the cultural slang that's out there, but it's been around forever, and, you know, often a good preacher should warn the young people about, you know, cultural norms and all that. But there is one, and it's been around for a long time. I think I've just been listening to it. But there's one cultural slang, that phrase, that I have really started to like. And if I could say it more genuinely and like it's supposed to be said, I think I'd use it. But it's that one, I got you. I got you. That, to me, that's a neat cultural phrase. And it just means, you know, I understand you. And a lot of people, you know, in the service industry will say, you know, down south at least, in our area, you know, you order a coffee, or, you know, you're explaining this three-syllable coffee to him, and I got you. You know, I get it. I understand what you're saying. I'm talking the same language. I know what you want. I'm there for you. I got it covered. And that's what we need to be as Christians for each other, is I got you. You know, you don't have to worry. You can tell me about your problems. I got you. I got your back. I'm going to be there for you. And I'm not talking about defending wrong and so on, but, you know, compare that to how we often, if we don't say it out loud, we're thinking, I think it sometimes, like, I don't get you. In fact, you're a weirdo. You're a strange duck. I never did understand. Like, you moved in here 5 years ago, and I still don't understand where you come from. That's the other side of doing it. And so, you know, this whole thing of being there, and what was the point again? Bearing one another's burdens. Serving an invisible God, proving to the people around us that there is a God by bearing one another's burdens. Point number two is simply a serving each other. And it's close, these are all close related, but treating each other with kindness, especially the vulnerable, the weak. And it's related to serving. Now, you know, we know that Jesus said that this has always been directly equated to serving God. Jesus said, you know, the righteous say to him that day, Lord, when saw we thee hunger and fed thee, or thirsty and gave thee drink? Or when saw we thee a stranger and took thee in, or naked or clothed? You know these verses. Or when saw we thee sick or in prison? It's kind of a tongue twister to me. And come unto thee, and then the king shall say, you know, verily, verily, I say unto you, inasmuch as ye have done it unto one of these, the least of my brethren, ye have done it unto me. And And I'm thinking now of the Ghana dungeons, you know, this whole thing of when heaven comes down to hell. And, you know, I was really thinking about that. Like I said, I really want to go visit those dungeons sometime. But, you know, if you just do the mental, you know, put yourself there for a minute and just imagine just below you right now. It's quiet. You can hear the groans of the slaves under your feet. Boy, the preacher's up here preaching about God. And one, you get up and you go downstairs, go to the basement, and you begin to serve those slaves, those suffering. They're passing out in the heat. They're dying. It's a mess. Now, all these people up here are slave owners. They've running through the jungle. This is collateral down here. This is assets. And now you're down there serving them. That's what Jesus did. Jesus didn't just stay up in heaven and say, hey, I hope you guys are all doing good. Like, he came down, heaven came down to hell. Entered into our suffering. That's one of the most beautiful things about the cross. Jesus, what is God doing on a cross? Entering into our suffering. And it's one of the things that, how do we do that? This place we live, the world we live, God has always been interested in the strangers, the widows, the distressed. But again, I'd like to mostly bring it back. You know, we can go outside and, you know, in our church, one of the things I appreciate the ladies have started doing is having a widow's day. Every year they have a widow's day, and they just, it's really gotten to be a thing in the community. It's like there's a lot of widows show up. They have a nice meal and, you know, all the stuff. And that's great. I'm bringing it kind of tight into our group here because that's the basis, right? Until we get that foundation right. And those in our own church, because Galatians there says, okay, it says this in the first Galatians 5, so this is, it says, for brethren, ye have been called unto liberty, only use not your liberty for an occasion to the flesh, but by love serve one another. And then Galatians 6 says this, as we have therefore the opportunity, let us do good unto all men, but then especially to those of the household of faith. So, I mean, if you're not good to the people the closest to you, you're not going to be good to the people that are, you know, even though it's a lot easier because they don't know you very good, but you got to be good to the people close to you. And that's where my mind's going. Okay, following me? Okay, so in that context, Jesus said in John 13, and, you know, in our Baptist circles, when you do communion, I don't know where you do it. You come up, I'm assuming you wash feet. You come up and wash feet, and that's, you know, people that aren't used to that are like, ooh, that's kind of funny. But there's some real metaphysical, spiritual things in that. It's one of those dynamic things that if you stop and think about, and, you know, one of the things that, so Art Katz, I've listened to a little bit of his, he's long gone, but he was a young, he was a Jew in post-war. He had lived through World War II. Jew, post-war Europe. Okay? Following. Can you even imagine putting yourself in this young man's shoes? Young single guy just come through World War II where 6 million of his people were killed. And he's walking around and he's destroyed Europe. He's a cynic. He's an atheist. He's trying to figure out. He's a smart young guy. He's trying to go, what is the meaning of life? Where do I go from here? What do I do with myself? So he's hitchhiking down the road. I forget which country it was. And it's raining. He's carrying a bag with him, just all his earthly belongings. And this car pulls over right in front of him. And really nice car. Obviously a well-dressed man. He's wealthy. He comes over there and says, hey, jump in. I'll take you for a ride. Grabs his wet suitcase, opens the back door, tosses it in on those nice, I don't know if they're leather seats, but he said it was an impressive car. He's in there with his old wet clothes, sits in the passenger seat. They take off into town. The guy pulls over to a little diner, takes him inside and feeds him. And they begin to talk, and he's just at a loss. They start talking about life, and this man is talking to him, and he says, this man's a Christian. And he goes, Art, he says, You know what the world needs? And in his testimony, he said his mind just spun. He's like, that's exactly the question I have. I have no idea what the world needs. He was completely blown away by the answer, and the man said, men need to wash each other's feet. Post-war Europe. Men need to wash each other's feet. You know, it was a series of things and neat stories that he finally got converted, but that was one of the steps. He never forgot that. The Holy Spirit gripped him with that. The idea of service. And when you serve people, they're gripped by that. Why did you do that? Why are you serving me? We can serve each other. One way to really arrest or to impress your love for a person is by serving them, by doing something beautiful for them. I'm not going to that much more, but that is another way that we can show an invisible God. You can love an invisible God. You can show the world an invisible God. I love the soup kitchen you guys had. That is showing an invisible God to all those young students. What is it? The third one now, cultivating faith. This is how we can see an invisible God, show an invisible God, and listen to this point close. I kind of struggle with how to word it. It's a little bit long, a little bit wordy, but this is another way to show people in your church, around you, an invisible God, is by cultivating faith, by fighting for each other instead of against each other. Okay? Jude says, build up your most holy faith. Before that, it says, contend earnestly for the faith. Do you know what 9 times out of 10 it feels like what happens when we start contending for the faith? What do you think happens? Like a famous uncle of mine says, first it's the committee, and then it's the U-Hauls. That's too often our experience with contending for the faith. And yet later on it says, but ye beloved, building up your most holy faith, praying in the Holy Ghost, keep yourselves in the love of God. There's only so many interpretations of what that means, to keep yourself in the love of God. And my contention is, my theory is on Scripture, is that we have the opportunity to contend for the faith by fighting for each other instead of against each other. What do I mean by that? I mean that, you know, when you see your frenemy, I'm going to call him a frenemy. You know what that means? He's your brother in the church, but he's one of those weirdos, and you know, you always knew his children weren't going to turn out because he was such a weirdo, you know. And so what do you expect? And sure enough, his children start to act like that, and so you know, you're like, I don't know, you know, somebody better find out, so I'll tell the preacher. But you know, if you could take your frenemy's teenager and fight for that soul instead of against him and say, hey, I'm going to stand between him and the preacher as long as I can. I'm going to take him out. And that's one thing I feel blessed. I have people in our church that take my young people out for coffee. How you doing? Fighting for each other. You get that? You see where I'm going with that? Like, you have that opportunity to cultivate each other's faith, to build each other up, your most holy faith, not just my, it's plural, not just saying, build up your most holy faith by fighting each other's battles. And this is one of the things that, you know, in Numbers 32, I think we were talking about Jordan today, weren't we? You were just over there and visiting, and that the whole thing where the tribes were on one side of the river. I think that's the case there, where in Numbers 32, the story of Reuben and Gad with their cattle, and they were like, well, this looks good to us. You can correct me if I'm wrong. They got up there and they're like, Moses, you know, this looks really a good cattle country to us. You know, we'll just stay here. And Moses is like, we're all going in there to fight the Philistines and all them. If you stay here, that's serious. And they kind of had a big misunderstanding there, and they're like, wait a minute. Hold it, Moses. Hold the horses. We're not, we'll go in there and fight the land, and then we'll come out, and, you know, when it's all conquered. And that's the way it should be, you know, to fight each other's battles. We're in it for the long haul. We want everybody to be successful, or else we're going to all feel it. Do you go to war? You know, I've heard someone say before about somebody who's like, boy, you don't want to go to war with that person. You know what they mean by that? It's like, boy, when the time gets hard, you look around and, well, where did he go? You know, he's all of a sudden he's gone. But there's people I want to go to war with, and by that they're gonna be there. You know, they know my weakness. They know I'm not, but they're gonna be there for me. And that, I just think that is such a beautiful way. You know, church. You know, do you go to war for people, or do you disappear when things get? Are you one of those people they can trust? Are you gonna? You know, it's just kind of fun to tell my uncle, my friend, my cousin, my buddy that, boy, that guy. Are you gonna defend his honor, his integrity, like it was your son, like it was? I sure hope. I don't want anybody to know that. I just, when things start to blaze, when things get hot, are you there? For your brother, for your people, fighting each other's battles. You know, it should be a safe place to confess, to tell, to open up, to say the wrong thing about God sometimes, or doctrine, or to just, you know, blurt something out, and boy, that was stupid. But is the church a safe place to be that person? Lift up the hands that hang down. Ye that are strong, restore the weak. Okay, and then the last point I have here is simply this: the sacrifice of the greater love. And that is one of the ways we show to the world, we show to our church brothers, we show to everyone around us the fact, the proof of an invisible God. That's how we worship an invisible God. What do I mean by that? This last point: the sacrifice of the greater love. Well, we know the commandment, love your neighbor. You know, Jesus said that. Love your neighbor as yourself. According to 1 John 4, verse 20, loving people you can see is the tangible expression of loving the God you can't see. Well, in Luke chapter 10, verse 27, it says, Jesus said, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, with all thy strength, with all thy might, and thy neighbor as your favorite dog. What was that? Thyself. Well, that phrase changes the dynamics. Just how much do you love yourself? That's how much you should love your neighbor, your church brother. And then, you know, for most of us, that is a pretty deep abiding love. It is a pretty loyal love. It is a pretty steady love. It's a long-suffering love. You think about how you treat yourself. You care about yourself the way you want to be treated. Loving an invisible God is loving your neighbor as yourself. And so in John 15, verse 13, it says this, and this is where I get the title for this last point. Greater love hath no man than this, than a man lay down his life for his friend. The sacrifice that comes out of the greater love, the greater love. And the story I want to put with this, because it's such a powerful story, I'm really trying not to just be an entertainer with my preaching. I'm trying to just less anecdotes and more just Bible. But this one moved me. I loved it because I like history. The battle of Berezna. I don't know how many of you heard of this. Napoleon. When he took over the world. He was a powerful man. He was a hard man. He was a world conqueror. And he made the classic mistake Hitler did, and he punched a hole way up into Russia. And he found out that Russia's big. And when it's wintertime, it's cold. And so he headed back out. The Russians right behind him. And they got to the Berezin River. I think I'm saying that right. It was a low flowing river, pretty wide, not real deep, but pretty wide. I've seen paintings of it, kind of wide sprawling river, and kind of the banks didn't go up really fast. They're just kind of marshy, and so this was in November, and it was like one of those winters where, boy, it should be cold by now, and it's not, and so it had frozen. Of course, during the battle, the Russians and everybody had been hard on the bridges. All the bridges were destroyed, but now they're in retreat. and they're trapped up against the Brisbane River, and the Russians are trying to find them. They kind of lost track of them. They didn't have drones and all that back then, and the Russians, they were playing, you know, these deception games and ploys and trick, and they had a few days to cross that river. And Napoleon was there with his, I think it was hundreds of thousands of men. And the Dutch engineers, they were very talented. They were ordered, you got to build us a bridge across that river. And they worked day and night. And you can see pictures of it, drawing and painting, as they took pilings. You know, I don't know if the river is 8 feet deep, whatever. They cut wood, they worked day and night, putting pilings, cross braces, planks across, building a bridge out across there. They got down in the water to study the pilings. It's quite a story if you read it. And early in the morning or late in the evening, when that bridge was finally done and the order was given, start across there. They lined up their horses, their people, and it was just a stream of people. When they got across, Napoleon got across, and they looked back. They said it was one of the few times that Napoleon shed tears. As he looked down there across that bridge, and he saw those Dutch engineers frozen to the piers. They had literally given their life, bracing up that bridge so that hundreds of thousands of soldiers could retreat and save their lives. When I think of the cross, when I think of the cross of heaven, how Christ got on that cross, he fastened himself to that pier, became a bridge to us. That's what it's talking about. Greater love hath no man than this, than a man lay down his life for his friends. That cross was a bridge from heaven to earth, and the one that made that bridge possible was Jesus. The cost was the highest mankind has ever witnessed. It was a recovery mission. It was a mission of love. It was a rescue mission. It was a redemption mission from certain destruction from the enemy. And the relationship that take this sacrifice often, the relationships that we develop among ourselves, they often take a sacrifice, often a deep, personal. You know, we talked about my nephews and the trauma of life, how life gets so messy. It can come from sin, it can come from accidents, it can come from sudden death, it can come from all kinds of things, but life is traumatic for people. And to develop that kind of bridge to someone that's in a mess, you know, where you can give up, you can sacrifice your time, you can sacrifice your, you know, and sit there with a person, and probably for you men, probably one of the hardest things, at least for me, is to sit there in the rubble of someone's life without solutions, without quick answers, without, you know, patent statements and cliches. Just sit there. I'm just here to be with you. I don't have any idea how God works either, but I'm going to sit here with you. And sometimes it takes that. Sacrifice comes in all kinds of ways. And I'm not saying we have to be just super dramatic, but sometimes, you know, in our go-go world, well, let's, you know, come on, you know, you can get over it, let's, you know, because, you know, I got a 3 o'clock appointment. Life doesn't work that way. So it's this sacrifice, this greater love, the sacrifice of the greater love. And like the Dutch engineers that died on the Brisbane River, you know, the world won't know God, they won't know, what else would soften the heart of Napoleon? What else would prove to him? You know, they won't know. How else will we love an invisible God? How is it we show the love of an invisible God? It's when we become a reflection of the love of Christ, our loyalty, the love and the sacrifice, the pathway for a traumatized world, a traumatized brother, a traumatized sister, to the cross of Jesus Christ. Us doing our part to point them to Christ so that Christ can point them to God. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Heavenly Father, we just want to thank you that we